By the summer, Rosenberg had been ousted and the GVG had fallen under the control of Hermann Esser, returned in May from his exile in Austria, and Julius Streicher. But the coarse personalities, insulting behavior, and clumsy methods of Esser and Streicher merely succeeded in alienating many Hitler followers. Far from all Hitler loyalists in any case had joined the GVG. Gregor Strasser, for example, a Landshut apothecary who was to emerge in the post-Putsch era as the leading figure in the party after Hitler, joined the Deutsche Völkische Freiheitspartei, DVFP, a rival Volkish organization headed by Albrecht Graefe, formerly a member of the conservative DNVP with its stronghold in Mecklenburg and its headquarters in Berlin. Graefe and two other dissidents from the DNVP, Reinhold Wulle and Wilhelm Henning, all members of the Reichstag with good connections to former officers and businessmen, had formed the DVFP in Berlin in the late autumn of 1922, wanting a more radical Volkish line than that offered by the DNVP. Hitler had been forced to a temporary agreement with Graefe in March 1923, allowing the DVFP dominance in northern Germany, with the south retained for the NSDAP. A further agreement, reaffirming that of March and recommending close cooperation between the two parties, had been signed by Hermann Esser on the 24th of October 1923. It was subsequently claimed by Rosenberg and others that Esser had acted without Hitler's knowledge and that the latter had not disowned the pact only to save Esser's face. But since Hitler had agreed to the March arrangement, and since it is scarcely probable that Esser could or would have taken such a step without his approval, this is unlikely. The agreement had not caused any conflict before the putsch, and in fact Graefe had taken part in the march to the Feldherrnhalle on the 9th of November. But conflict was not long deferred once Hitler was in prison. The DVFP had been less affected by a proscription than had the NSDAP. In contrast to the disarray within the Hitler movement, Graefe and the other DVFP leaders were still at liberty to control a party organization left largely in place. And though the DVFP leaders lauded Hitler's actions in the putsch in an attempt to win over his supporters, they were actually keen to take advantage of the situation and to establish their own supremacy. That the DVFP leaders advocated electoral participation by the Volkish movement added to the growing conflict. A move towards a parliamentary strategy alienated many Nazis and was vehemently opposed by NSDAP diehards in northern Germany. Their spokesman, Ludolf Haase, the leader of the Göttingen branch, was increasingly critical of Rosenberg's authority and, above all, keen to keep the North German NSDAP from the clutches of Graefe. Rosenberg's position was still further undermined when a draft agreement with Graefe, allowing for unified party organization and combined leadership, which the acting Nazi leader had turned down at a secret meeting in Salzburg at the end of January, was then accepted after all at Ludendorff's insistence on the 24th of February. This was with Hitler's express permission, though stipulation that the agreement should last for only 6 months. It was a further sign of how little clear and unequivocal guidance those left trying to run a party, banned and in disarray, were given by their imprisoned leader. Immediately after this, on the day before the trial of the putschists began, Ludendorff publicly recommended support for Graefe as his representative in North Germany, thereby lending his prestige to the DVFP and at the same time tacitly claiming leadership of the Volkish movement. Those Volkish groups that were prepared, however reluctantly, to enter Parliament in order to be in a position one day to destroy it, decided to enter into electoral alliances to allow them to contest the series of regional Landtag elections that began in February, and the Reichstag election, the first of two that year, on the 4th of May 1924. Hitler was opposed to this strategy. As Rudolf Hess, on Hitler's behalf, was still explaining over a year later, Herr H. was against participating in the elections from the first moment onwards, and said this clearly and plainly to a number of gentlemen, including His Excellency Ludendorff. He was convinced that the movement was not mature enough, that we also had to stay true to our principle of anti-parliamentarism, and that money was only squandered pointlessly. Hitler's opposition made no difference. The decision to participate went ahead. It seemed to be borne out by the results. In the February Landtag elections in Mecklenburg-Schwerin, Greffer's stronghold, the DVFP won 13 out of 64 seats. And on the 6th of April, in the Bavarian Landtag elections, the Völkischer Bloc, as the Electoral Alliance called itself there, won 17% of the vote. Even after these results, Hitler was still letting it be known that he opposed the activities of the Völkischer Bloc in the forthcoming Reichstag elections. Yet, at the very same time, he allowed his name to go over an electoral proclamation of the Bloc. And soon after the election, he told Kurt Lüdecke that policy would have to change, and that we shall have to hold our noses and enter the Reichstag against the Catholic and Marxist deputies. How he viewed this was made plain a year or so later by Rudolf Hess replying for Hitler to a letter from a party member. Herr Hitler is of the view that after Parliament was entered against his will, participation in Parliament has to be seen as one of many methods of combating the present system, including parliamentarism. But participation should not be positive cooperation, as was unfortunately carried out by the Völkisch parliamentarists with very little success, but only be through the fiercest opposition and obstruction, through constant criticism of the existing system in Parliament. Parliament, or better still, parliamentarism, should be taken to absurdity in Parliament. The Reichstag election results had, it seems, helped persuade Hitler that the parliamentary tactic, pragmatically and purposefully deployed, promised to pay dividends. The Völkisch vote, bolstered by the publicity and outcome of the Hitler trial, had stood up well, with a result of 6.5% and 32 seats in the Reichstag. The results in Greffer's territory of Mecklenburg, 20.8%, and Bavaria, 16%, were particularly good. That only 10 of the Völkisch Reichstag members were from the NSDAP, and 22 from the DVFP, gave some indication, however, of the relative weakness of the remnants of the Hitler movement at the time. In the first of two visits he paid to Landsberg in May, Ludendorff, whose contacts in North Germany were extensive despite his continued residence near Munich, seized the moment to try to persuade Hitler to agree to a merger of the NSDAP and DVFP fractions in the Reichstag, and in the second meeting, even to full unity of the two parties. Hitler equivocated. He agreed in principle but stipulated preconditions that needed to be discussed with Greffer. One of these, it transpired, was that the headquarters of the movement would be based in Munich. The meeting with Greffer did not take place, however, before the Reichstag deputies of the two parties came together in Berlin on the 24th of May and agreed to merge for parliamentary purposes under the name of the National Socialist Freedom Party, Nationalsozialistische Freiheitspartei, NSFP. Ludendorff compromised Hitler's position by announcing in a press release that the latter supported the creation of a single, unified party. Hitler was in difficulties because, though he had always insisted on a separate and unique identity for the NSDAP, there was the danger, following the electoral success of the Völkischer Bloc, that such an uncompromising stance would seem less than compelling to his supporters. Moreover, the DVFP was the stronger of the two parties, as the election had shown, and Ludendorff was now generally regarded as the leading figure in the Völkisch movement. Hitler's weakness, reflected in his habit of telling people what they wanted to hear, was revealed in a hastily arranged visit to Landsberg by a four-man North German Nazi delegation led by Haase at the end of May. Hitler insisted that the agreement with the DVFP of the 24th of February had been presented to him as a fait accompli, that he had opposed electoral participation but had been unable to prevent it, and that unity with the DVFP went no further than the combining of the Reichstag fractions. Ludendorff immediately cast doubt on Hitler's sincerity in a published statement on the 11th of June, flatly contradicting such a version and stressing Hitler's acceptance of the need for a merger. However, the result of the visit by Haase's delegation was the establishment on the 3rd of June 1924 in Hamburg by the North German Hitler loyalists of a directorate, under the leadership of Dr. Adalbert Volk, a lawyer based in Lüneburg, whose embracing of the Völkisch movement was strongly coloured by his Baltic origins. The directorate totally rejected any notion of a merger with the DVFP, which it felt would lead to it being sucked into parliamentarism and becoming a party like others. Consequently, the Directorate aimed to be a tightly knit, centrally controlled organization, loyal to Hitler and holding to his principles until he could be released to take up the reins again. Even so, some North German Nazis were not surprisingly confused and uncertain about Hitler's position regarding any merger. In a letter of the 14th of June, Hauser sought confirmation that Hitler rejected a merger of the two parties. Replying 2 days later, Hitler denied that he had fundamentally rejected a merger, though he had stipulated preconditions for such a step. He acknowledged the opposition among many Nazi loyalists to a merger with the DVFP, which, he also pointed out, had made plain its rejection of some of the old guard of the party. Under the circumstances, he went on, he could no longer intervene or accept responsibility. He had decided, therefore, to withdraw from politics until he could properly lead again. He refused henceforth to allow his name to be used in support of any political position and asked for no further political letters to be sent to him. A week later, Hermann Fubke, a young Nazi from the Göttingen area, imprisoned with Hitler in Landsberg and acting as his general factotum and go-between with the North German faction, tried to assuage Hauser by assuring him of Hitler's support for the opposition of the North German National Socialists to the DVFP. All in all, Fugger summed up, Hitler thinks things have gone so hopelessly off the rails that he is in no doubt that he will have to begin completely afresh when he is free. But in such a case, he is very optimistic and of the view that he will have firm control again within a few days. Fugger could not resist, however, pointing out his own disappointment at Hitler's indifference to the cries of distress of the North German NSDAP. Hitler announced his decision to withdraw from politics in the press on the 7th of July. He requested no further visits to Landsberg by his supporters, a request he felt compelled to repeat a month later. The press announcement gave as his reasons the impossibility of accepting practical responsibility for developments while he was in Landsberg, general overwork, and the need to concentrate on the writing of his book, the first volume of Mein Kampf. A not insignificant additional factor, as the opposition press emphasized, was Hitler's anxiety to do nothing to jeopardize his chances of parole, which could be granted from the 1st of October. The occasion for his decision was Ludendorff's press statement on the 11th of June, which had embarrassed and angered Hitler by claiming, despite the latter's caution and equivocation, that he openly supported the merger of the two parties. Fugger told Hauser on the 23rd of June that the decision to withdraw from politics had been born out of the anger over this statement. However, the dominant reason was doubtless the one he had given Hauser, his impotence at controlling developments from within Landsberg. The Ludendorff press release had simply been the last indication of this impotence. His withdrawal was not a Machiavellian strategy to exacerbate the split that was already taking place, increase confusion, and thereby bolster his image as a symbol of unity. This was the outcome, not the cause. In June 1924, the outcome could not be clearly foreseen. Hitler acted from weakness, not strength. He was being pressed from all sides to take a stance on the growing schism. His equivocation frustrated his supporters. But any clear stance would have alienated one side or the other. His decision not to decide was characteristic. Hitler habitually rationalizes his choices, commented Lüdecker. He was prepared to risk everything rather than delegate a portion of his personal authority while he remained confined. Hitler's frustration was also increased by his inability, despite his outright disapproval, to curtail Röhm's determination to build up a nationwide paramilitary organization called the Frontbahn. This was intended to absorb and unify other existing paramilitary leagues of the Folkish movement, including the SA and the other band units of the former Kampfbund, and to be placed under the military leadership of Ludendorff. Hitler was allergic to the inevitable loss of control over the SA, which would certainly follow, and concerned to avoid his own dependence, as before the putsch, on leaders of paramilitary organizations. Above all, he was anxious that what might be seen as his renewed involvement in paramilitary politics would hinder his chances of early parole and encourage moves to deport him back to Austria. Unable to deter Röhm, already freed on the 1st of April, bound over on probation, his derisory 15-month prison sentence for his part in the putsch set aside on condition of good behaviour. Hitler ended their last meeting before he left Landsberg on the 17th of June by telling him that, having laid down the leadership of the National Socialist Movement, he wished to hear no more about the front ban. Röhm nevertheless simply ignored Hitler and pressed on with his plans, looking to Ludendorff for patronage and protection. Following Hitler's press statement about his withdrawal from all political involvement, Ludendorff and Greffe moved quickly, with their own press release 2 days later, to claim the leadership of the Folkish movement until the liberated hero of Munich can again step into their circle as the third leader. Hitler, they stated, had asked them to take over the leadership in his place. At the same time, Rosenberg had resigned his position, and Gregor Strasser had been brought into the Reich leadership, Reichsführerschaft of the NSFP, along with Ludendorff and Greffe, for the duration of Hitler's internment. A conference planned to take place in Weimar in mid-August would bring unity in the Folkish movement, they added. This horrified the northern Nazis. The directorate sought clarification from Fobke. They were told that Hitler had given up his leadership only during his imprisonment, had delegated his powers to no one, and had had no part in the appointment of Strasser to the Reich leadership, though this step had met with his approval. The directorate's leader, Fulk, once more on the 18th of July, made plain where the Northern National Socialists stood on questions of a merger. "Our program consists of two words, Adolf Hitler." But a meeting of 80 NSDAP representatives from across Germany at Weimar on the 20th of July, gathered to discuss the merger issue, which would explicitly arise in the conference in the same town the following month, and the question of a parliamentary strategy, and with Ludendorff as guest of honour, ended in acrimony, recrimination, disorder, and greater division than ever. Fulk immediately compiled a highly critical report of events which he sent to Landsberg. Hitler's reply to his intermediary, Fobke, offered some encouragement to the northern group. He said they were on the right track. He strongly criticized Ludendorff, who, he commented, should concentrate solely on the military side of the movement. He was also critical of Esser and Streicher. However, he refused adamantly to deviate from his position of neutrality towards the various rival factions. At the same time, he regarded the merger issue as finished and played down the significance of the conflict. He had scant sensitivity for the North German National Socialists in their despairing struggle. He knew what he had to do on release, and the rebuilding of the movement could only start from Bavaria. Fulk was unenthusiastic about Hitler's response, which he thought showed little understanding for the NSDAP's position in the North. It was the first sign of Fulk's growing criticism of Hitler. "When leaders in the first place think they can judge everything alone and better," he commented, "we won't get any farther." The much-vaunted conference in Weimar on the 15th to the 17th of August intended to cement the organizational merger of the NSDAP and DVFP produced only the most superficial unity in a newly proclaimed National Socialist Freedom Movement, Nationalsozialistische Freiheitsbewegung, NSFB. A high point of the conference was a greetings telegram from your leader, Adolf Hitler, that was read out to ecstatic applause and threatened to upstage Ludendorff, though he had in fact solicited it in the first place. "Unity without Hitler's leadership could not be attained," was the implication of the conference. But Hitler's leadership, of the kind he would demand, was, it became increasingly apparent, incompatible with the expectations of Ludendorff and Greffe of a type of leadership triumvirate. Once more, the embattled northern group of fundamentalists, worried by Hitler's greetings telegram to the conference, turned to him for clear, unambiguous guidance. Once more, he disappointed them. Wobke's reply tried to reassure his northern comrades that Hitler did not accept that the two parties had completely merged, nor that the movement had become parliamentarized. But he accepted the need for compromise and for parliamentary action. Hitler, through Fobke, expressed once more his wish to refrain from any statement of opinion. He ended by emphasizing that his priority on release which he fully expected to be on the 1st of October, would be to restore order in Bavaria. He simply exhorted the Northern Directorate to hold out until then. The North Germans were distinctly unimpressed. By the end of the summer, the fragmentation of the NSDAP and of the Völkisch movement in general was, despite all the talk of merger and unity, advancing rather than receding. The crudely insulting, overbearing and bullying style of Streicher and Esser stirred deep rancor even within the GVG, caused great antagonism with the Völkischer Bloc, whose leader in Bavaria, Gregor Strasser, was also, of course, a member of the Reich leadership of the NSFB, and totally alienated the Northern National Socialists. They in turn rejected the Reich leadership of the NSFB, which, for its part, refused to accept that the Directorate had any authority. Only Hitler's position was emerging, significantly strengthened by the inner party warfare. As summer dragged into autumn, then winter approached, the rifts in the Völkisch movement widened still further. Hitler assured the Northern Loyalist faction in mid-September that on release he would seek a clean break and summon all those in leading positions to a meeting. The only question at issue would be, who should lead the movement? Or rather, who stood behind Hitler as sole leader? Hitler does not recognize a Reich leadership, Fobke's letter stated, and will never be part of such a soldiers' council construction. So there was no question of him joining Ludendorff and Greffer in a combined Reich leadership. But he refused to make a public statement to that effect. The frustration and impatience of his northern supporters mounted. His failure to gain the release on parole from the 1st of October that his supporters had been anticipating further complicated the situation. From the NSFB's point of view, unity without Hitler, and in the face of his continued refusal to commit himself publicly to a unified organization, was impossible. In Bavaria, the Völkisch feud surrounding the figures of Esser and Streicher widened into open breach. On the 26th of October, the Völkischer Bloc decided to join the NSFB to create a united organization to fight the coming elections. With this, it accepted the NSFB's Reich leadership. Gregor Strasser, the spokesman of the Völkischer Bloc, hoped that the Großdeutsche Volksgemeinschaft would also soon join the NSFB, but at the same time openly condemned its leaders, Esser and Streicher. Hess's reply in a letter to all GVG affiliations, a bitter attack on the leaders of the Völkischer Bloc, with a sideswipe at Ludendorff for his support of the Bloc's position, reaffirmed the Munich loyalist position. The only man who has a right to exclude someone who has fought for years for his place in the movement of National Socialists is solely and singly Adolf Hitler. But Esser's bravado and the brash attacks of Streicher, supported by the Thuringian National Socialist Arthur Dinter, could not conceal the sharp decline of the GVG. The Reichstag elections that took place on the 7th of December demonstrated just how marginal this perpetual squabbling in the Völkisch movement was to the overall shaping of German politics. The NSFB won only 3% of the vote. It had lost over a million votes compared with the Völkisch showing in the May election. Its Reichstag representation fell from 32 to 14 seats, only four of whom were National Socialists. It was a disastrous result. But it pleased Hitler. In his absence, Völkisch politics had collapsed, but his own claims to leadership had in the process been strengthened. The election result also had the advantage of encouraging the Bavarian government to regard the danger from the extreme right as past. There was now, it seemed, no need for undue concern about Hitler's release from Landsberg, for which his supporters had been clamoring since October. 2. The hopes of Hitler and his supporters for his early parole on the 1st of October, once the stipulated 6 months since his sentence had elapsed, had depended on attestation of his good conduct while in prison and on his intentions after release. In a report on the 15th of September, the governor of Landsberg prison, Oberregierungsrat Otto Leibold, along with most of the warders warmly sympathetic to Hitler, painted a eulogistic picture of his prize inmate. Hitler shows himself to be a man of order, of discipline, not only with regard to his own person, but also towards his fellow internees. He is contented, modest, and accommodating. He makes no demands, is quiet and reasonable, serious and without any abusiveness, scrupulously concerned to obey the confinements of the sentence. He is a man without personal vanity, is content with the catering of the institution, does not smoke or drink, and despite all comradeliness, knows how to command a certain authority with his fellow inmates. He is not drawn to the female sex. He meets women with whom he comes into contact on visits here with great politeness, without becoming engaged with them in serious political discussions. He is always polite and never insulting towards the officials of the institution. Hitler, who at the beginning had a great number of visitors, has kept for some months, as is well known, as far as possible from political visits, and writes only few letters, mainly notes of thanks. He occupies himself every day for many hours with the draft of his book, which should appear in the next weeks, and will contain his autobiography, thoughts on the bourgeoisie, Jewry and Marxism, German Revolution and Bolshevism, on the National Socialist Movement and the prehistory of the 8th of November 1923. During the 10 months of his remand and sentence, he has without doubt become more mature and quiet than he had been. He will not return to liberty with threats and thoughts of revenge against those in public office who oppose him and frustrated his plans in November 1923. He will be no agitator against the government, no enemy of other parties with a nationalist leaning. He emphasizes how convinced he is that a state cannot exist without firm internal order and firm government. This paean of praise convinced neither the Munich police nor the state prosecutor's office, both of which provided clear and compelling reasons for rejecting Hitler's early release. The report of the deputy police president of Munich, Oberregierungsrat Friedrich Tenne, of the 23rd of September 1923, warned in the strongest terms against parole. The deputy police president recalled the assessment the police direction had earlier made in a report of the 8th of May 1924. Given Hitler's temperament and the energy with which he pursued his goals, that report had stated, it could be taken for granted that he would not give up his aim after release from prison, and would constitute a constant danger for the internal and external security of the state. Events since then had confirmed that assessment. The deputy police president drew attention to the statements of Hitler, Kriebel, and Weber at their trial that they would continue in the same vein after release. And he referred to documents found on the 16th of September in the offices of the Frontbahn, which, it was claimed, proved the involvement of the internees in the reformation of the dissolved paramilitary bodies. There could in these circumstances be no question of parole, the report went on, but should the court grant it, against all expectations, then it would be crucial to deport Hitler as the soul of the entire Volkisch movement, and so remove the imminent danger for the Bavarian state. The report described prophetically what could be expected after Hitler's release. Hitler's influence on all those of a Volkisch mind, he is today more than ever the soul of the whole movement, will not only stop the regressive development of the Volkisch movement, but will unite the currently fragmented parts and lead great masses of those supporters of his idea who have already fallen off and are still detached back to the NSDAP. Meetings, demonstrations, public outrages, and a ruthless struggle with the government would be the outcome. The state prosecutor for the judicial district of Munich I, Ludwig Stenglein, who had served as the chief prosecutor in the Hitler trial, also emphatically underlined in a letter of the 23rd of September how little Hitler's intentions had changed during his imprisonment, that it could be presumed he would take up where he had left off, and what a danger for public order Hitler's release would constitute. Implicitly hinting how scandalous the trial had been, he also stressed the serious criminal nature of Hitler's behavior before and during the putsch. Not only had the attempted putsch endangered the Bavarian state and the German Reich, it had resulted in considerable loss of life, a major robbery of banknotes, and premeditated armed conflict with the police. The prosecutor pointed out that Hitler's conviction in 1922 for breach of the peace had earned him a month's jail sentence with 2 months suspended sentence, on probation until the 1st of March 1926, something which ought to have been, but was not, mentioned at his trial. He sought the withdrawal of the probation. The evidence connecting Hitler with the plans to reconstitute the banned paramilitary organizations showed, the prosecutor alleged, what he and his fellow internees Kriebel and Weber had in mind after such a release. It also demonstrated, through the misuse of their privileges in Landsberg, in smuggling out letters by way of visitors who had been allowed to see them in private, their lack of good conduct during their internment. There could be no grounds, he concluded, for an early release, and he recommended rejection of parole. The court simply set aside the state prosecutor's arguments, and on the 25th of September approved the parole. It took the view that, considering the persons concerned and the motives for their actions, the serving of a relatively light sentence would be sufficient punishment. It regarded the bypassing of the censor in smuggling out a few letters of insignificant content as a minor consideration, which did not affect the excellent conduct of the internees, attested by the declaration of the prison governor. There was no proof, it stated, of connections between Hitler and Kriebel and the Frontbahn. In this, the court was presumably influenced by the public declarations by Röhm and others dissociating Hitler from the Frontbahn. Nor were there any grounds, the court stated, to accept the state's prosecution request for a revocation of the existing probationary period being served by Hitler from his sentence of 1922. Undeterred, state prosecutor Stenglein worked over the weekend to prepare a further appeal against parole for Hitler, Kriebel and Weber to be sent to the Bavarian Supreme Court. This was delivered on Monday, the 29th of September. It repeated the charges of poor conduct through at least 9 cases of smuggled letters, strong suspicion of participation in further illegal organizations through involvement with the Frontbahn, and the security risk that would present itself for the state on their release. With this appeal, there was no possibility that Hitler could be released, as he and his supporters had pressed for on the 1st of October. However, the matter was pending, the court would soon have to decide on the parole, and the prospects of preventing Hitler's early release were not great. Even if parole were not immediately forthcoming, the chances were that it would be granted before much longer, not least given the unrelenting pressure from Hitler's supporters. With this in mind, a representative of the Bavarian government visited Vienna at the beginning of October to try to secure the deportation of Hitler to Austria, which it wanted to achieve immediately if he were released on parole. In response to a Bavarian inquiry as early as the 26th of March 1924, the authorities in Upper Austria had in fact recognized Hitler's Austrian citizenship on the 20th of April and been prepared to accept his deportation over the border at Passau. A report by the Munich Police Direction on the 8th of May then recommended his deportation in the interest of Bavarian state security. But no steps were taken then, or at any other time before late September. Presumably the matter had simply been deferred as non-urgent. By September, when a sense of urgency was certainly present, the Bavarian cabinet was divided on Hitler's deportation. In any case, by then the Passau border authorities were reporting that they had received orders from Vienna not to accept Hitler. The directive had been sent on the instructions of no less authority than that of the Federal Chancellor, Ignaz Zeipel himself. Subsequent Bavarian attempts to use legal arguments, in themselves persuasive, to pressurize the Austrian government to take back Hitler were to no avail. Zeipel simply refused to take him, remaining adamant that Hitler's service in the German army incurred loss of Austrian citizenship. It was legally not a sound argument, but it sufficed. Despite Hitler's fears, nothing more came of the attempt to deport him. Following his release from Landsberg, Hitler inquired in March 1925 how he could relinquish his Austrian citizenship. He was told to put in a formal request, which he then did on the grounds of his war service in the German army and desire to acquire German citizenship. On the 30th of April 1925, he received the anxiously awaited authorization that his Austrian citizenship was terminated. This removal of any fear of deportation at a future date cost him the grand sum of 7.50 Austrian shillings. It would be 7 years before he acquired German citizenship. Until then, he would remain stateless. Meanwhile, on the 6th of October, the Bavarian Supreme Court gave its judgment, rejecting the state prosecutor's plea opposing Hitler's parole. The court took the view that the strong suspicion against Hitler, Kriebel and Weber for involvement with banned paramilitary organizations had still to be proved. The decision on parole hinged on this evidence and could only be taken when it was available. The judgment paved the way for the eventual order of the 19th of December, which would grant Hitler's release. The State Prosecution Office had still not given up. It made a last attempt to prevent Hitler's release in a carefully argued appeal of the 5th of December. Even if the evidence assembled might not suffice for a court conviction, it claimed, it did suffice to demonstrate the strong suspicion that Hitler and Kriebel, whatever their protestations to the contrary, were guilty of actions in the same context as those for which they had been sentenced, and that they were unlikely to be of good conduct after release. The Bavarian Supreme Court then requested, on the 12th of December, a report from the governor of Landsberg on the conduct of Hitler and Kriebel since his earlier report of the 15th of September. Reading the signals, Lebold replied within 2 days with another glowing account of Hitler's character and behavior in the prison. "He is in his conduct during his sentence," Lebold concluded, "quite especially worthy of parole." With this new documentation of Hitler's good conduct, the Bavarian Supreme Court, on the 19th of December, finally rejected the state prosecution's case against early release and ordered his parole, the clamour for which had not ceased in the Folkish press since October. That the December elections were out of the way and appeared to show National Socialism in steep decline doubtless helped. But only political bias explains the determination of the Bavarian judiciary to insist upon Hitler's early release despite the well-reasoned opposition of the Munich police and the state prosecutor's office. State prosecutor Stenglein, who had himself done what he could to hinder Hitler's parole, now passed on the court order to Landsberg by telegram. The governor, his voice faltering, gave his prisoner the news. Hitler assured him there would be no demonstrations outside the prison and asked to be collected by Adolf Müller, proprietor of a Munich publishing firm and the party's printer. Müller drove the next morning to Landsberg in his Daimler Benz, together with the photographer Heinrich Hoffmann. On the 20th of December, at 12:15 p.m., Hitler was released. A calculation in the files of the State Prosecution Office noted that he had 3 years, 333 days, 21 hours, 50 minutes of his short sentence still to serve. History would have taken a different course had he been made to serve it. The prison staff, all sympathetic to Hitler, gathered to bid their famous prisoner an emotional farewell. He paused for photographs by the gates of the old fortress town, hurrying Hoffmann because of the cold, then was gone. Within 2 hours he was back at his Munich apartment in Tierstrasse, greeted by friends with garlands of flowers and nearly knocked over by his dog, Wolf. Hitler said later that he did not know what to do with his first evening of freedom. Politically, he continued at first to remain publicly non-committal. He needed to take stock of the situation in view of the months of internecine warfare in the Folkish movement. More important, it was necessary in order to establish with the Bavarian authorities the conditions for his re-entry into politics and to ensure that the ban on the NSDAP was lifted. Now that he was released, serious preparation for his party's new start could begin. 3. Landsberg, Hitler told Hans Frank, was his university, paid for by the state. He read, he said, everything he could get hold of. Nietzsche, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Ranke, Treitschke, Marx, Bismarck's Gedanken und Erinnerungen, thoughts and memories, and the war memories of German and Allied generals and statesmen. Other than dealing with visitors and answering correspondence, neither of which preoccupied him much once he had withdrawn from public involvement in politics in the summer, the long days of enforced idleness in Landsberg were ideal for reading and reflection. But Hitler's reading and reflection were anything but academic. Doubtless he did read much. However, as we noted in an earlier chapter, he made clear in Mein Kampf that reading for him had purely an instrumental purpose. He read not for knowledge or enlightenment, but for confirmation of his own preconceptions. He found what he was looking for. As he told Hans Frank, the party's legal expert, who would eventually become governor-general in occupied Poland, through the reading he did in Landsberg, I recognized the correctness of my views. Sitting in his cell in Nuremberg many years later, Frank adjudged the year 1924 to have been one of the most decisive turning points in Hitler's life. This was an exaggeration. Landsberg was not so much a turning point as a period in which Hitler inwardly consolidated and rationalized for himself the worldview he had been developing since 1919, and in some significant ways modifying in the year or so before the putsch. As the Nazi movement fell apart in his absence and with time on his hands, away from the hurly-burly of active politics, Hitler could scarcely avoid ruminating on past mistakes. And expecting his release within months, he was even more strongly compelled to look to the way forward for himself and his broken movement. During this time he revised, in certain respects, his views on how to attain power. In so doing, his perception of himself changed. He came to think of his own role in a different way. In the wake of the triumph of his trial, he began to see himself as his followers had started to portray him from the end of 1922 onwards as Germany's savior. In the light of the putsch, one might have expected his self-belief to be crushed once and for all. On the contrary, it was elevated beyond measure. His almost mystical faith in himself as walking with destiny, with a mission to rescue Germany, dates from this time. At the same time, there was an important adjustment to another aspect of his world view. Ideas which had been taking shape in his mind since late 1922, if not earlier, on the direction of future foreign policy, were now elaborated into the notion of a quest for living space to be gained at the expense of Russia. Blended into his obsessive anti-Semitism, aimed at the destruction of Jewish Bolshevism, the concept of a war for living space, an idea which Hitler would repeatedly emphasize in the following years, rounded off his worldview. Thereafter there would be tactical adjustments but no further alteration of substance. Landsberg was no Jordan conversion for Hitler. In the main, it was a matter of adding new emphases to the few basic idées fixes already formed, at least in embryo, or clearly taking shape in the years before the putsch. The modifications in Hitler's worldview that had already been taking shape in the year before the putsch are clearly evident in Mein Kampf. Hitler's book offered nothing new, but it was the plainest and most expansive statement of his worldview that he had presented. He acknowledged that without his stay in Landsberg, the book, which after 1933, though not before, would sell in its millions, would never have been written. Its genesis is not altogether clear. If Otto Strasser, admittedly a biased and often unreliable source, is to be believed, it was his brother Gregor who, during the short time he spent in Landsberg, had the Machiavellian idea of suggesting to Hitler that he write his memoirs in order to relieve the burden on the other inmates of having to listen to endless monologues from the man on the first floor. Hitler was taken with the idea, began work on it straight away, and the prisoners on the ground floor were left in peace to return to playing cards, eating and drinking. At least, they thought they would be left in peace. If the story has any substance to it, they must have been sorely disappointed when Hitler took to reading out each day the sections he had written to a literally captive audience. More likely, if more prosaic than Otto Strasser's colourful explanation, is that the suggestion to Hitler to write his autobiography came from Max Ammann, persuading him to cash in on the publicity stirred up by his trial. Ammann was expecting revelations about the background to the putsch. Instead, he and many disappointed readers found largely a repetition of what Hitler had said in countless speeches, interspersed with superficial and triumphalist accounts of parts of his own life story. Hitler was already at work on what would become the first volume when Haase and the North German delegation visited him on the 26th to the 27th of May 1924. He called his book at that time by the scarcely catchy title, 4.5 years of struggle against lies, stupidity, and cowardice. The eventual pithy title seems to have been suggested by Max Ammann. The book was dictated by Hitler to Schofer and General Dogsbody Emil Maurice, then from July onwards to Rudolf Hess, both of whom were also serving sentences for their part in the putsch. The first volume, which appeared on the 18th of July, 1925, was largely autobiographical, though, as we have noted, with many distortions and inaccuracies. It ended with Hitler's triumph at the announcement of the party programme in the Hofbräuhaus on the 24th of February 1920. The second volume, which Hitler wrote only after his release, and which was published on the 11th of December 1926, dealt more extensively with his ideas on the nature of the Folkish state, questions of ideology, propaganda, and organization, concluding with chapters on foreign policy. Badly written and rambling as the published version of Mein Kampf was, it was a considerable improvement on what Hitler had initially produced, thanks to editorial interventions from a number of people. A veritable chaos of banalities, schoolboy reminiscences, subjective judgments, and personal hatred, was how Otto Strasser described the draft. Ammann, the party printer Müller, Hess, and Hanfstengel, whose brother turned down flat the prospect of Mein Kampf appearing in the family publishing house, all had a hand in altering and revising the text. The music critic of the Völkische Beobachter, Stolzing-Serne, together with a former Hieronymite, Father Bernard Stempfler, one-time editor-in-chief of the Miesbacher Anzeiger, a provincial Bavarian newspaper that sympathized with the Nazi movement, played the main role in recouching whole sections into a style still inimitably Hitlerian, often barely readable, but nonetheless more literate than the original. Even then, there were many later alterations before the volume appeared in print. Hitler himself, according to Hans Frank, accepted that it was badly written and described it as no more than a collection of leading articles for the Völkische Beobachter. Before Hitler came to power, Mein Kampf, brought out in the party's own publishing house, the Franz Ehr Verlag, run by Max Ammann, was scarcely the runaway bestseller he had apparently expected it to be. Its turgid content, dreadful style, and relatively high price of 12 Reichmarks a volume evidently deterred many potential readers. By 1929, the first volume had sold around 23,000 copies, the second only 13,000. Sales increased sharply following the NSDAP's electoral successes after 1930 and reached 80,000 in 1932. From 1933, they rose stratospherically. 1.5 million copies were sold that year. Even the blind could read it, should they have wished to do so, once a Braille version had been published in 1936. And from that year, a copy of the People's Edition of both volumes bound together was given to each happy couple on their wedding day. Some 10 million copies were sold by 1945, not counting the millions sold abroad, where Mein Kampf was translated into 16 languages. How many people actually read it is unknown. For Hitler, it was of little importance. Having from the early 1920s described himself in official documents as a writer, he could well afford in 1933 to refuse his Reich Chancellor's salary. In contrast, he pointed out to his predecessors, Mein Kampf had made him a very rich man. No policy outline was offered in Mein Kampf, but the book did provide, however garbled the presentation, an uncompromising statement of Hitler's political principles, his world view, his sense of his own mission, his vision of society, and his long-term aims. Not least, it established the basis of the Führer myth. For in Mein Kampf, Hitler portrayed himself as uniquely qualified to lead Germany from its existing misery to greatness. Mein Kampf gives an important insight into his thinking in the mid-1920s. By then he had developed a philosophy that afforded him a complete interpretation of history, of the ills of the world, and how to overcome them. Tersely summarized, it boiled down to a simplistic, Manichaean view of history as racial struggle, in which the highest racial entity, the Aryan, was being undermined and destroyed by the lowest, the parasitic Jew. The racial question, he wrote, gives the key not only to world history but to all human culture. The culmination of this process was taken to be the brutal rule of the Jews through Bolshevism in Russia, where the blood Jew had, partly amid inhuman torture, killed or let starve to death around 30 million people in truly satanic savagery, in order to secure the rule over a great people of a bunch of Jewish literati and stock market bandits. The mission of the Nazi movement was therefore clear: to destroy Jewish Bolshevism. At the same time, a leap of logic that moved conveniently into a justification for outright imperialist conquest, this would provide the German people with the living space needed for the master race to sustain itself. He held rigidly to these basic tenets for the rest of his life. Nothing of substance changed in later years. The very inflexibility and quasi-messianic commitment to an idea, a set of beliefs that were unalterable, simple, internally consistent and comprehensive, gave Hitler the strength of will and sense of knowing his own destiny that left its mark on all those who came into contact with him. Hitler's authority in his entourage derived in no small measure from the certainty in his own convictions that he could so forcefully express. Everything could be couched in terms of black and white, victory or total destruction. There were no alternatives. And like all ideologues and conviction politicians, the self-reinforcing components of his worldview meant that he was always in a position to deride or dismiss out of hand any rational arguments of opponents. Once head of state, Hitler's personalized worldview would serve as guidelines for action for policymakers in all areas of the Third Reich. Hitler's book was not a prescriptive program in the sense of a short-term political manifesto, but many contemporaries made a mistake in treating Mein Kampf with ridicule and not taking the ideas Hitler expressed there extremely seriously. However base and repellent they were, they amounted to a set of clearly established and rigidly upheld political principles. Hitler never saw any reason to alter the content of what he had written. Their internal coherence, given the irrational premises, allows them to be described as an ideology, or, in Hitler's own terminology, a worldview. Hitler's worldview in Mein Kampf can now be more clearly seen than used to be possible in the context of his ideas as they unfolded between his entry into politics and the writing of his second book in 1928. On Hitler's central, overriding and all-embracing obsession, the removal of the Jews, Mein Kampf added nothing to the ideas he had already formulated by 1919-20. Extreme though the language of Mein Kampf was, it was no different to that which Hitler had been proclaiming for years. Nor, for that matter, did the inherently genocidal terminology substantially vary from that of other writers and speakers on the Volkish Right, extending, as we have already seen, well back beyond the First World War. His bacterial imagery implied that Jews should be treated in the way germs were dealt with, by extermination. Already in August 1920, Hitler had spoken of combating racial tuberculosis through removal of the causal agent, the Jew. And there could be little doubt whom Hitler had in mind when 4 years later in Mein Kampf he wrote, "The nationalization of our masses will succeed only when, aside from all the positive struggle for the soul of our people, their international poisoners are exterminated." The notion of poisoning the poisoners ran through another notorious passage of Mein Kampf, already cited in Chapter 5, in which Hitler suggested that if 12,000 to 15,000 Hebrew corruptors of the people had been held under poison gas at the start of the First World War, then the sacrifice of millions at the front would not have been in vain. These terrible passages are not the beginning of a one-way track to the final solution. The road there was twisted, not straight. But however little he had thought out the practical implications of what he was saying, its inherent genocidal thrust is undeniable. However indistinctly, the connection between destruction of the Jews, war, and national salvation had been forged in Hitler's mind. As we saw in Chapter 5, the initial anti-capitalist coloring of Hitler's anti-Semitism had given way by mid-1920 to the connection in his thinking of the Jews with the evils of Soviet Bolshevism. It was not that Hitler substituted the image of the Jews behind Marxism for that of the Jews behind capitalism. Both coexisted in his fixated loathing. It was a hatred so profound that it could only have been based on deep fear. This was of a figure in his imagination so powerful that it was the force behind both international finance capital and Soviet communism. It was the image of a Jewish world conspiracy that was almost unconquerable, even for National Socialism. Once the link with Bolshevism was made, Hitler had established his central and lasting vision of a titanic battle for supremacy, a racial struggle against a foe of ruthless brutality. What he visualized, he had stated in June 1922, was a fight to the death between two competing ideologies, the idealistic and the materialistic. The mission of the German people was to destroy Bolshevism, and with it, our mortal enemy, the Jew. By October the same year, he was writing of a life and death of two opposed worldviews, incapable of existing alongside one another. Defeat in this great showdown would seal Germany's destruction. The struggle would leave only victors and the annihilated. It meant a war of extermination. A victory of the Marxist idea signifies the complete extermination of the opponents, he remarked. The Bolshevization of Germany means the complete annihilation of the entire Christian Western culture. Correspondingly, the aim of National Socialism could be simply defined: annihilation and extermination of the Marxist Weltanschauung. By now, Marxism and the Jew were synonymous in Hitler's mind. At the end of his trial on the 27th of March 1924, he had told the court that what he wanted to be was the breaker of Marxism. The Nazi movement knew only one enemy, he had emphasized the following month, the mortal enemy of the whole of mankind, Marxism. There was no mention of the Jews. Some newspapers picked up the change of emphasis and claimed Hitler had altered his position on the Jewish question. There were Nazi followers who were also puzzled. One, visiting him in Landsberg at the end of July, asked Hitler whether he had changed his views about Jewry. He received a characteristic reply. Indeed, his position on the struggle against Jewry had altered, Hitler remarked. He had realized, while at work on Mein Kampf, that he had, up to then, been too mild. In future, only the toughest measures could be deployed if success were to be attained. The Jewish question, he declared, was an existential matter for all peoples, not just the German people, for Judah is the world plague. The logic of the position was that only the complete eradication of the international power of Jewry would suffice. Hitler's obsession with the Jewish question was inextricably interwoven with his notions of foreign policy. Once his anti-Semitism had, by the middle of 1920, fused with anti-Bolshevism into the image of Jewish Bolshevism, it was inevitable that his thinking on foreign policy would be affected. However, not only ideological influences, but questions of pure power politics shaped Hitler's changing position. In their concentration on France as the arch-enemy, hostility to Britain, recovery of colonies, and the restoration of Germany's borders of 1914, Hitler's early views on foreign policy were conventionally pan-German. They were no different from those of many nationalist hotheads. In fact, in essence, if not in the extreme way they were advanced, they accorded with a revisionism that enjoyed wide popular backing. Nor, in his emphasis on military might to overthrow Versailles and defeat France, however unrealistic it sounded in the early 1920s, did he differ from many others on the pan-German and folkish right. Already in 1920, before he had heard of fascism, he was contemplating the value of an alliance with Italy. He was determined even then that the question of South Tyrol, the predominantly German-speaking part of the former Austrian province of Tyrol, lying beyond the Brenner, ceded to Italy in 1919, and since then subjected to a program of Italianization, would not stand in the way of such an alliance. By late 1922, an alliance with Britain, whose world empire he admired, was in his mind. This idea had sharpened in 1923, when the agreements of the British and French over the Ruhr occupation became clear. The presumed rule of the Jews in Russia stood, on the other hand, as Hitler had pointed out as early as July 1920, firmly in the way of any alliance with Russia. Even so, at this time Hitler shared the view of many on the folkish right that a distinction could be drawn between national Russians, where the Germanic influence was strong, and the Bolshevization of Russia brought about by the Jews. Hitler's approach to Russia was partly shaped by Rosenberg, the early NSDAP's leading expert on Eastern questions, whose Baltic origins fed a ferocious antipathy towards Bolshevism. It was most likely reinforced by Scheibner Richter, another prolific writer on Eastern policy in the Infant Party, with extremely strong connections to Russian exiles. Dietrich Eckart, too, who was already in early 1919 writing of the identity of Jews